Evening, ladies and gentlemen, reconvening the steering committee. I'm Doug Fogler. My co-host is Ryan Barkey, and tonight we're gonna do a little scuttlebutt here at the beginning. Talk a little bit about what's been going on with us and cars. I went out and saw a Ford V Ferrari last night, and I loved it. So we're gonna talk about that, and then we'll kind of see where the conversation goes from there. So,
I didn't make it to the movies. I'm a little jealous. I did go out for a drive today, though.
Yes, yeah, which is, I'm actually more jealous of that. So, yeah,
it was neither a Ferrari or a Ford, but I do have a McLaren story.
Yeah, well, there we go.
I took the Cayman out and had a nice drive in the canyons.
And Bruce McLaren was, he's prominently featured in this story, so that's it all ties together.
You're absolutely right, or at least from what I know of the story. Mm-hmm. Took the car out, had a nice drive in the canyons, did my usual round. I'm getting a little bored with my roads, though. I've got to push my boundaries, find some new roads. What's the term?
Expand your horizons.
Break some new trails.
That's the appropriate Colorado Western term.
Is that the term? I don't know.
I know what you're talking about. We need to pioneer some find a new mountain pass. To get over the hills.
Now that I've mastered all the clothes, I'm kidding. but no, it would
you
be
might
nice
for to, all we know you might have the record on the Golden Gate Pass.
That's
so
true. Yeah. In my dreams, but it was a nice day. I had to get out, and like I said, a lot of sand in the corners, but it was still a lot of fun. And on the way back, was on the interstate here, and decided to go a little further than my usual exit and double back. Just I wasn't quite ready to put her away yet, and was coming back onto the interstate, onto the highway entrance ramp, sort of one of these where three lanes goes down into two, two lanes into one. And then you get on the highway, and there was a vision in my rearview mirror. It was a McLaren, and I didn't know what kind. It was sort of a dark purple, and I knew he was going to try to pass me on the right before we went down from two lanes into one. And I was in third gear, doing about 40, and I punched it, and he caught up to me pretty quickly and was able to pass me on the right just before two lanes went into one. The Cayman. Cayman's a good car.
So from what you're saying basically is that he was able to dive bombed you and got around you. But the traffic opened up, you guys got a chance to go at it.
And we were doing
as your attorney, I'm gonna say
yes, okay.
We'll leave it as you were doing an exceptional amount of speed.
And I don't know much about McLarens, and I've told you this, and I knew it was something special. I knew it wasn't your run of the mill was it MPC-12 or whatever? It's not what it is. What is
wasn't
it?
One of those.
I don't know much about McLaren.
Yeah, it wasn't the entry model. Which turned into this, the 720.
No,
it wasn't that.
I knew it wasn't Senna. Anyway, but
tell our audience what you think it was.
So it was a P1. It had to have been a P1. I just based on the headlights, the taillights, the wing, the color, which I think was specific to the P1. And so, like I told you, if you have to get passed by someone, why not have it be a P1? Have to be emasculated.
I don't even think you realize when it happened, what sort of class warfare you were involved with there.
I fully recognize that any McLaren is faster than my car by a good margin. We're looking at them. That was definitely a P1, but
definitely
that's
P1.
My store and I'm sticking to it. Yeah. But even if it had been a 600 or something, it's obviously a much faster car than mine, and it's still nothing to be embarrassed about, but I'm pretty sure this is a P1. So if you're listening, you live in Denver, and you just bought a P1, I think it had temp tags on it, let us know. But
You're one of our people.
Thanks for the thumbs up and the wave as you broke
away. That's always cool.
Once we got moving, that came with a little traffic running interference, I was able to keep up okay. What was incredible, though, is he basically started from a stop, and I was already, in third gear doing 40 or 50 miles an hour, and he was able to close that gap and still just pass me.
I didn't know that. So he accelerated from zero, up, caught up to you, got around you, and then was able to go on point.
But I didn't hear the whoosh. I wasn't blown into the weeds. I think considering what I was driving, I made a good showing of myself. But it was pretty cool. You don't see those every day. And I'm 99% sure it was a P1. And I think I've seen this car cruising around before now. If you're listening and this was you and it wasn't a P1,
feel free to
let me know.
Email us at the steering committee.
Yeah, this is my story and I'm sticking to it. And But again, I don't know much about McLarens. Didn't know much about McLarens. I've never really had much of an interest. And I knew the P1 was something special. I didn't realize that those are trading for between $1.5 million and $3 million right now, and that a McLaren P1 was also the fastest car that Motor Trend had ever has ever tested. So, again, if
that's you out there, then, you know, write us at thesteeringcommittee@gmail.com and let us know.
Yeah, so, cool car, and appreciate the thumbs up.
Yeah, well, I'm glad he did that. I'm glad whoever was driving, it seems like he was cool.
And I think it was his thumb. Could have been his middle finger.
It was some finger. Some appendix was gestured towards you.
Yeah, I think
you,
it was. But he seemed like a decent enough guy, and I appreciate the gesture. And thank you for entertaining a poor man in his base Cayman. So.
Well, you know, and now, and by association, a poor man without any sports car. I'm enjoying this story, you know, just hearing about it. So, I've never seen one of these in the wild, so to speak. I've obviously seen them all over, you know, social media and TV and Top Gear and the Grand Tour, but I've never seen one in real life. You said it had real presence, though, right?
It did. You know, I was looking through the pictures again. We all have the cars we're into. For me, it's Porsche and McLaren, not so much, although I appreciate them for what they are. I did have to sort of reacquaint myself with the models today, just to make sure it wasn't a lesser, you know, a used $100,000. Tell me, what is it? The MPC 112? What is it? MPC? The very first one that came out.
Yeah, the first one was the MPC. Or 12. MP412C.
MP412C. Yeah, that's what.
And they shortened it at some point to just the 12C, I believe.
That's right.
They did a mild facelift on it, and they changed the name
still
a little
the
bit.
Same taillights, though. And
the back three quarters, at some point they redid the front after the P1 came out. They redid the front fascia to make it look more like the P1.
This was not bad, and I'm 99% certain that it was the P1. Again, P1. It was definitely not the Senna. That was kind of a
that one stands out.
I think it was a P1 and pretty cool. And that's my story. I'm sticking to it. And you don't see one of those every day. Maybe if I had been driving a 918, I could have given more of a run for his money. But I'm telling you that the base 718 came and continues to impress me. Again, it's no $3 million McLaren, but that car can scoot. I wasn't as embarrassed as I probably should have been.
Or could have been,
Could have been. But.
Well, there you go. There's a steering committee top tip for you. Go ahead and just save $1.5 million and get a Cayman.
That's right.
Get 85% of the experience.
Yes, it's exactly the same.
I get confused with these a little bit too. I sort of know them, but not really well. There's the 570 line, right? And then there's the 720.
And that's a 540 too, right?
There's a 540, but that's kind of in the five. They have like that sort of that entry level sports car market, and then they have the 720.
Yeah,
and then now they have the GT as well.
Yeah, which is cool in its own way, but definitely a different sort of take on that.
Definitely a different take. I don't know. I was watching DeMiro's video about it. And I thought I don't think I love the way it looks, though. I don't think I'm in love with the way it looks.
It's
distinctive looking.
Ferrari has their new sort of. Soft Ferrari or GT. It's got
the
multi-spoke wheels.
It's like a mid-level GT car now, right? Because they have the Portofino as the entry level, right? That's the convertible that used to be the California.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I think it's the Portofino. Yeah. They have the super fast at the top of the food chain. But now they have this the Roma, right? The Ferrari Roma they just introduced.
This is all this week.
Yeah,
that noise you hear.
If you can hear it,
Doug, we were just talking about this. Every time I come over, they're doing construction in front of your house, and
they're doing some version of always ripping up the road and replacing water pipes in front of my house for some reason. So today on a Sunday. At 7 o'clock in the morning, they started jackhammering outside our house.
And now it's a Sunday evening at 7:30.
Yeah, and they're still working out there. I guess it's a busy, it's a crucial sort of artery road that I live on, and they have to get it somewhat fixed so that traffic can get across it tomorrow morning. So
I come back the next time and they're doing something out there, I'm thinking that you're just targeted.
That I'm.
They know you've got a couple of infant twins that
just messing with me
about this time.
It's been affecting them. They their bedroom is unfortunately pretty close to all this. So well. Hopefully it's not too loud for our audience here, but yes, if you're commuting into Denver on 8th Ave, just be prepared for a large bump at the intersection of Cook Street. So,
It'll be filled with gravel and then forgotten.
It'll be gravel, but it'll still leave a pretty big dip, yeah, I bet. So be careful with your, if you have a sports suspension. I get a little confused with the model lineup and sort of where all the cars sort of fit on it. It's a little bit confusing for me.
It's a huge range of pricing, which I didn't have an appreciation of, but
That first car, that 540, 570 model line, I think that they have that one sort of priced at like a 911 turbo level. So that's as cheap as they come, basically.
Yeah, about 160,000, I think.
Right? But it's gotten good reviews. People say it's a great bargain at that price.
Even for a car enthusiast, it's sometimes hard to tell between that and the multi-million dollar P1.
But. Yeah, I mean, they have a... They're a little confusing to me in some cases. I think I'm coming around on them. I don't think I was ever that interested in them. I'm a little bit more interested in them than I used to be, but they definitely seem to always suffer from that, a little too digitalized versus analog. It seems like they're getting better at that, but they're a little, they're a great science experiment, but not necessarily a great passion project. So
not for me, but if you do want to beat a Cayman to the merge,
If you're looking to pick off base Caymans at the entrance ramps, that's your car. It's interesting though. You said that you might have been able to do better if you had a 918, the Porsche, right? You're talking about the hypercar.
I know,
we've all seen a number of those, head to heads of the Holy Trinity between this and the Porsche and the LaFerrari. I've seen at least two head-to-heads where the Porsche was quicker than the P1 around a racetrack. Yeah.
Well, so Motor Trend historically was never the place to go for. Car and Driver is always the Bible for me as far as testing and numbers, right? But
on the Grand Tour episode where they put them all together, the Porsche was faster than the McLaren, and I think in Chris Harris, he was the first guy that got all three of them together. But I think he kept the race tires on the car when he did his lap, he was faster with that.
We talked about what a difference tires can make, right?
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd probably take the. I mean, if I were to take one of those cars, I would have to go Porsche, but
that would be your favorite
they're all so close in performances to be.
They were performance-wise, they were close for me. I never liked the LaFerrari. It never did it for me. I don't know why.
I can again appreciate it for it. Can't speak tonight.
Yeah, it's okay. Appreciate it for it's late technical. On a Sunday night. We're trying to bring this to your audience here.
You're clamoring.
We're the ones working here for you, so hopefully you appreciate this. Right. I appreciate it for the numbers. I appreciate it for the performance and everything. But it never did anything to me. I guess. If it came down to it, I would have picked the Porsche as well.
I
don't know. There's something about it. It looked great. I think it looked awesome. It introduced some really interesting P1 technology.
Did do something
to me. Well, the P1 did. Yeah. Well, now you're gonna say yeah.
Yeah. But anyway. But well, yeah, interesting day. I'm always amazed at what you see in Denver driving around. And you know what? He was kind of headed in the direction of the Cherry Creek Mall, but it wasn't parked out front, so he was actually out there driving it. So.
Well, and hopefully the fact that it was a friendly gesture he gave you, because otherwise, you're right, there's certain people that will sort of buy those cars and just kind of cruise around Cherry Creek and not be very nice about
it. This guy definitely gave it the beans. And a purple McLaren P1 is probably not the car you want to go around flipping off people in.
So
I'm gonna say it was.
We're gonna assume it was a friendly gesture.
As I'm 99% sure it was a P1, I'm 99% sure that was a thumbs up. Anyway, but I want to hear about the movie. I want to hear about you have not bought anything yet.
I haven't. I have no updates in that area. Although, after our weekend together driving driving some Porsches up in the mountains, I am kind of wondering if I'm making a mistake by looking past those.
Did you drive the 997?
Still haven't driven a 997. No. So I want to do that with you at some point. I want to go together and do that. So.
But you rode in both back to back.
Yes.
Can I ask you for some quick impressions between? So my car again, 2017 718.
Yeah.
Cayman manual. And we were driving with a buddy in his 2006.
So 2006 Targa or 7, four. Targa 4.
So 997.1, also manual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Cabin layout is very different. Your car, it's definitely you feel you're sitting down low in a what's clearly a mid-engine car. Not as much visibility out of the front and back.
Something I don't like. I came from 997, and it's something I miss.
It's a more steeply raked windshield. It feels like it's a smaller amount of glass that you're kind of looking out of. You definitely feel lower. You slip into the 911 and you're almost, it's not quite like slipping into like a Toyota Camry or something, but it just feels like a much more everyday car. Mm-hmm. I think it's just because I think with the glass just being a little bit more upright, a little bit more space. It's not a tremendous amount more space, but somehow it just, with all that glass, it just feels like it's a little bit bigger.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
The sensation of speed was higher in your car. I felt at times like when we were going fast, we were going faster.
In a straight line or on corners?
Both. And I'm not saying necessarily that like I felt different in your car. It felt like the speed felt more like it was coming through the cabin and coming to my sensories. Whereas like in the 911, at one point. Our buddy Will was driving, and he had to get around a guy to catch up with you. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, we were going, we caught up with you, and I knew we were going kind of fast. But he kind of like looked down real quick, and he was like, "Oh, that was 110." Yeah. And I was like, "Oh, that didn't feel like it. That felt like 70 or 80." So.
How much of that sort of that sensation do you think had to do with just I had a lot of exhaust? That's what we talked about. That like how much of the experience is the sound and
I'm sure that's related to it. It wasn't all that though. It wasn't just that your car is louder, and that you're sitting closer to the engine. Yeah. Because we're sitting even further away from the engine in the 911 with the seats and a little bit of distance there. And he doesn't have he has a. It's actually a sport exhaust on there that he had put on but not a. It's not an aftermarket or anything like that.
So, no, it wasn't. It wasn't nearly as loud as mine, from what I could.
No, it definitely is not. And he even said that.
Definitely has that Porsche six cylinder sort of signature sound that my four cylinder turbo doesn't, and it does sound good. I miss that sound sometimes, but and on paper these are two cars that should be fairly closely matched.
Yeah.
Obviously, one car is 11 years newer, but
11 years. But the horsepower numbers, horsepower numbers are relatively similar. Though you probably have more torque, right? I would think you have about 300 pounds per feet.
The same, is it? And on paper, I think so. His car would be about 320 horse.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
325.
Yeah, it's a 997.1, just base. Yeah, not an S.
But being the Targa with all that glass, I think I want to say the car's got 300 or 400 pounds over my car.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
And it's got a lot more miles. We're talking about 16,000 miles versus what?
He's like 170,000 somewhere like that. Yeah, that thing was tight though. He bought it with pretty high mileage used. It's his passion car. Yeah. It's his extra car. He likes, but he's been driving a lot. He says he says like it's been no problems with it.
Well, and I think he's probably more responsive. He was driving. He had his son in the car. He wasn't. Probably driving quite as hard as.
Yeah, no, he wasn't. Yeah, he wasn't. So. Yeah, he wasn't trying to win the 1966 Le Mans race. Red Mist hadn't descended.
Doesn't matter if it's a McLaren P1.
I can get it. Yeah,
I'm gonna go for it.
It's not the size of the car in the fight. It's this the fight of the car and the man or something. I don't know.
It was fun to get out and drive with him just curious because I came from a similar car, an 05, also 997 Carrera S, so a little more power in the rear-wheel drive. So probably about as different as two 997s could be, actually.
Yeah.
Short of like the GT3.
Yeah. There's an entire car manufacturer lineup in just the 911, variants, basically. I mean, they're so different from a convertible all the way up to a GT3. I mean, they're different cars. I mean, they completely different cars.
Yeah. It was fun. I mean, that's a good looking car,
I think that's the thing that we both sort of walked away with is we kind of realized or remembered how good that 997 really is. It just had great presence on the road.
Yeah,
and just
not a lot of bad looking 911s, but the 997 just is one of the good ones. There's this theory about how the best looking 911s skip a generation. Right, so that the 997 was a really strong one visually.
So the 991 is considered not as good looking?
Yeah, and the 996, and now we're at the 992 again, and I've heard it argued that Porsche almost cooks that in, but I don't know if that's true. But then before the 996 was the 993, arguably a better looking car than the 964, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think to add on to that theory, I think what they do is they always do like a mid-model recycle, yeah, refresh. Yeah. Yeah. And maybe that is built in. Maybe they know the true enthusiasts will always buy that first generation nothing, no matter what. But then they'll increase sales by fixing some of those cosmetic issues
by accident
with these Germans. Yes, but they know what they're doing.
Yeah, it was fun to get out. I would definitely like to trade keys with them at some point. And there was a reason I got rid of my 997. It wasn't just the IMS bearing. It wasn't just the window that rattled in the door. It wasn't just the HVAC buttons that were wearing away.
Yeah.
I could go on, right? I mean, it had some issues unique to that model, and it had some issues that come along with the car that's getting a few years on it. But it is still one of my favorite cars, and it was a lot of fun to follow on or see it in my mirror behind me.
Well, let's try and get over and test drive those two that are nearby.
I
kind of want your impressions on
them. Because we still have to get you in a car. And
you have to get me into something.
We won't talk too much about that today because I think we've been beaten to death.
Yeah.
I think probably next time.
Should I vow not to talk about it again until I have something interesting?
Well, I think we're getting close. I think the time of the year, the prices have come down. I think some cars have been sitting on lots for a long time. So I think you'll get into some.
We're getting there.
We'll devote a very special episode today. So,
yeah, very special holiday episode. Hopefully.
If you buy it, the next few weeks, are they going to deliver with a big red Lexus boat?
I would love that.
All right, we're going to take a break and we'll be back.
We'll be right back.
New movie out. There's this new movie out called Ford v Ferrari. Mm-hmm. And it talks about the...
I was confused. I thought it was Ford 5 Ferrari, but I was reading that wrong, I guess. But.
Yeah. You didn't go to art school? Sorry, recurring joke. I don't know what that means. But you saw it, I didn't. So I'm not going to be much use in this conversation.
Yes, I selfishly decided I just wanted to go see it, so I went and saw it myself. I left my wife and family, friends, everyone be home.
Break those chains of love.
I just had to. Yeah, I said this is more important, so I need to see this. Well, I'll give you a little background though. I've been raised hearing about this story. Yeah. Most fathers talk to their sons about great moments in baseball or football or, I'm from the Massachusetts area. You would think it would be all about Carl Yastrzemski or Ted Williams or something, and. I just didn't. My dad really wasn't into traditional sports, so for me, I was hearing about this great epic battle between Ford versus Ferrari at Le Mans, and so my dad would just tell it in such great excitement and passion. It got me really excited about it, and I just kind of had this idea of how all these things sort of fit together from a young age.
Let's establish exactly when these battles were taking place. Mm-hmm. When was this?
It was. It started in '64. It culminated with sort of the ultimate, victory, and what the story focuses on is 1966.
Okay. So this predates both of us by 10 years.
Yeah. It was all this was before my time. So it was just a thing of legends. It was kind of like tall, folk heroes and tall tales and things like that.
And not to get too in the weeds here, but is this something that was broadcast on television?
Absolutely. Okay. So at the time, Yeah, and that's so. Since being raised on the story, I went ahead and read the book "Go Like Hell," which is I think where this movie draws most of its inspiration and material from. There's been a lot of material on this particular subject of late. Adam Carolla did his documentary, "The 24-Hour War,"
these stories fuel the prices on the cars that are still around and the legends of these brands today. Oh, yeah. I mean, we're still tapping into these stories as a marketing tool now. I mean, this is...
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you get something like this going, and then you have one of these guys that owns one of these Le Mans-winning GT40s. You're sitting on a $20 million lottery ticket, basically. Right. So, which is some of the winning cars, that's what they're trading at. So, like I said, the story... it filled in a lot of those gaps for me. Those things like what you just asked, was this on TV at the time? Yes. What was interesting is that at that this time in America, it had captured the entire nation's attention.
Okay.
So like this endurance race was broadcast on primetime TV.
Which
so
probably didn't really, so, hadn't happened before and hasn't happened since, right? I mean,
it was an interesting moment in America where it's like most of the racing community in the United States was more focused on NASCAR and IndyCar.
Even then,
but like sports cars were becoming like a thing. They were catching, you know, people's attention, and they were, you know, people were starting to bring them over from Europe and race them, and little shops were being set up to service them, and people, you know. The book and the movie does a good job of explaining what you had is you had that the very first boomer generation, baby boomer generation, reaching their late teens, early 20s, and they had a little money in their pocket. They had been working, you know, and maybe some were going off to college, or some were, you know, working for, you know, good jobs, you know, good, you know, sort of, you know, industrial, you know, blue collar jobs, and they had, you know, coin in their pockets, and they wanted to spend it on something, and they wanted fast cars. And, you know, Ford at that time was basically had lost sort of, you know, a step. They, you know, lost ground to GM. GM had overtaken them and become the largest, you know, manufacturer of cars, even though Ford like invented mass production and, you know, was a pioneer in so many ways. And they were kind of in the doldrums. They were stuck making stodgy, boring cars that, you know, your grandfather drove, basically. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to stop that. They wanted to end that reputation. And through, you know, a bunch of corporate meetings, they ended up deciding that they needed to go win it, you know, this race. And I think what's interesting, I think, about the story in general is that it's the way it's told is that it was this David versus Goliath thing,
right?
Which is ironic because
Ferrari is
the Goliath in this version. It's not. It's really what it, you know. The Ferrari's entire budget is a rounding error for Ford, right? You know, in their accounting. It's like a, you know, just a drop in the bucket for their ledger. But I guess the way I would say it is that it's Ford is Goliath, but they had been beaten twice already by David, you know, and so Goliath was trying to get up off the mat and actually try and win. And that's kind of where the story focuses on is that leading into that 1966 race and what they had to do to get there. And
what cars are we talking about? This is the GT40 for Ford.
Yeah. So it's what started off is the Ford, and they show a little bit of this. They go into it a lot more in the book. It was a model they built called the Ford GT. It was heavily based on a Lola race car.
Right.
But, you know, and they had basically spent carte blanche with engineers over in England, you know, for the first two attempts with this car, but they just couldn't quite get all the pieces working on it. It eventually... you know, gets redeveloped as what's called the GT40, so-called, because it was 40 inches off the... Yeah,
it wasn't really 40 inches?
I don't know. I think so. It's probably... I mean, they always fudge on those rules a little bit, but... and then on the Ferrari side, I believe, and now I've realized I've overstepped over my bounds, but... I think it was called a P4, was actually the car, yeah. I'm
just going to throw that out there.
You just throw out numbers together and see. Yeah, it's... I mean, when you look at the thing, the Ferrari is a... It was a fantastic looking car. I mean, it's just incredible.
And this was never.
Neither of these cars. A few GT40s somehow made it into road production, but it was never a serious car that was produced. As far as I know, the Ferrari was never built as a road car. I mean, this is what we're talking about here. This era of. Sort of sports car endurance racing here. I got a picture of it for us to look at. I mean,
that's okay.
It's fantastic looking.
Seeing the picture, I know the car, but obviously, don't ask me what it's called.
You know, I'm sorry. You were saying 330
P4. I think it's a 260. No,
it's a 330. It's a 330 P4.
Okay.
Well, so a little bit more background on it is that, you know, Ford had tried to purchase Ferrari. Ferrari basically, canceled the deal at the last second in a particularly, apparently, like, you know, egregious way and insulted Henry Ford II along the way. So he being this, you know, titan of industry and, you know, alpha male, you know, just wouldn't have it and wanted to basically, you know, get him back and embarrass him. But in 1964... Ford, you know, fielded a bunch of cars, none of them finished. 65, bunch of cars, none of them finished. So Ferrari kept getting, like, you know, the last laugh on this thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as the book explains and as the movie goes into, maybe in a little heavy-handed of a way, but, you know, they hired, you know, they got Carroll Shelby involved. Right. Carroll Shelby brought his kind of ragtag Venice Beach crew along, and they got the GT40, you know, up to speed, you know, literally and figuratively. And the movie and the book do a great job of focusing on this one driver, Ken Miles. He was a you'd appreciate this based on what you were telling me before. You like to hear about guys who achieve greatness in sports after 40. He was 45 when he became involved with the team.
This is a sport.
Yeah, it is. Oh, yeah. And when you watch the racing footage, it's clear it's a sport. Yeah. I mean, especially the endurance racing is a whole other beast compared to other racing.
No power steering in these.
Oh yeah, I mean no power brakes, yeah, nothing. Yeah, I mean you're driving at night. You have to be focused and attentive. You know, throughout the whole thing. I mean, it's an endurance race. The body goes through a lot. But you know, he was this kind of wild card in the whole thing. He was English, World War II tank commander, fought all over from Normandy all the way into Berlin. And as a result of his commitment in the military was why he kind of got a late start to his racing career. Moved to California, was trying to He was trying to work as a MGA or MGB salesperson. Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
And racing on the side, but he definitely, like, racing was in his blood.
Yeah.
And Carroll Shelby had to fight tooth and nail to get him on the team, but he was a development guy. He was the guy actually working on the car, making it faster, working with the engineers, testing, and then, it wasn't clear whether he was going to get one of the, there were three cars entered in 1966, with two drivers each. It wasn't clear if he was going to get one of the seats. So all the other seats went to more established drivers, people who Ford thought of as being more corporate, and, he got one of the seats, and it's just, this movie does a great job of illuminating his career to people who probably don't know who he is.
Yeah.
He was an amazing driver. Yeah. It was just in his blood. So.
And you saw this at the Cherokee Mall.
Yeah. I didn't see, I thought when I was done with the showing, I rode my bike down and I pulled out quickly and I was like, I'm going to wait here by the parking lot and see if any interesting cars pull out. The theater was packed.
Purple people. Really?
Packed at 9:45.
That surprises me, but then.
No, this will be the biggest movie of the weekend by far.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I see that it premiered at the Telluride Film Festival. I just wanted to establish that didn't see it.
I didn't make it out to that. My invitation was lost from Matt Damon, I guess, on that one. So,
give it a year and we'll be able.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, he and I are back from Massachusetts together, connection. Yeah, so
it's like your brothers.
Yeah, we all know each other.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But no interesting cars, unfortunately, in the parking lot. So, but I mean, it's a fantastically done movie. I mean, everything is done right.
Yeah.
It has some great racing footage, but doesn't just focus on that. It's got some good character development. It's got great performances.
Originally, we were supposed to. We're both supposed to see this, and then
yeah. Well, as I said, I left everybody behind on this one. Yeah. So, yeah.
But I'm just proud of you for getting out and doing this.
Like I said, I've been waiting a long time to see this, and I really was excited when I heard that the movie was done well, had a full budget, big A-list actors.
Would you see it again?
Absolutely. I'll see it again for sure. So I recommend to any of our audience listening to definitely go check it out. It's a great, great moment in motorsports history. It's a great time. It's just I'd say, sort of in my quick rankings of car/racing movies, this is in the top three. It might be the number two right now.
So that's a question.
Yeah, which is number one?
Yeah,
and I guess I don't really put them in order, but Rush is up there. I don't know if you've seen
Rush. I've never seen Rush.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah,
it's great sports. It's just a good sports movie.
Okay,
a little light on racing. Doesn't have a ton of racing footage, but it's good. It's a great story. It gives you a great idea of what it was like to be a Formula One driver.
Okay.
And that one focuses on the 1972 World Championship season. And then I also go back and forth. It's probably Grand Prix, so it's an old 60s movie James Garner, directed by John Frankenheimer.
Yeah, did Ronin later.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is one of his earlier movies, and you can see there's the guy had a real gift for for filming cars at speed and stuff. So he's fantastic. Or he has a great second unit guy that does all that. I don't know, but he's got his fingerprint on a couple of great car movies. So
Days of Thunder is not on this list.
Days of Thunder for me is not. He's not in the. Although I have rewatched Days of Thunder more for the unintentional comedy more than anything. I there's certain. There's like 5 minute segments of Days of Thunder that I love, but I don't love the entire movie.
So I've never seen it. The closest I got to seeing it.
You've never seen Days of Thunder?
When I was in the 7th or 8th grade or freshman high school, whatever, I had my first girlfriend, right?
Uh-huh. And I noticed you put air quotes on that. Our audience couldn't see that. What does that mean?
She was a girl and she was a friend. Oh. But we went to the movies together.
We saw movies together.
Big deal. Yeah. And there were two screens, and we had our parents drop us off individually. And I was really trying to talk her into going to see Days of Thunder, but...
What'd you end up seeing?
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, all right. Well, that's not bad, yeah.
Double-check, make sure that those two weren't back out at the same time, but I'd be willing to bet that they were, because I was very disappointed, but I ended up enjoying...
The movie.
Days of Thunder, but...
Bill and Ted's.
But
to this day...
Probably holds up better...
Oh, absolutely.
And Days of Thunder. George Carlin was in it.
We probably need to sit you down and have you watch Days of Thunder just for fun, but you made a better choice.
Isn't that the movie that sparked the romance between, and the Scientology?
Yes, that's where Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise
met. Okay.
Or I like, I watched Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I love how one of the characters on the show always refers to him as Thomas Cruise.
I don't know Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
So. He's a very straight-laced character. He's like, why must you turn everything into a Thomas Cruise movie? It's a very, he's got a very deadpan delivery. That's the movie they met on.
Okay.
That one's fun to watch, but Driven, which was that Sylvester Stallone movie with the
IndyCars, right?
Yeah, he'd been shopping around a Formula One movie for years and couldn't quite get it done. You know, at the time, the sanctioning body was actually a CART.
It was during
the time when the two leagues split.
Yeah.
It was CART racing that gave him what he needed and. That's the kind of movie that just annoys me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you go in there and they make the racing just overly exaggerated. No, you know, they just
known for subtlety.
Yeah, I mean, at one point the two guys are racing the race cars on the streets because one of the guys, they're at a party and the cars are on display.
I know that doesn't happen.
Well, it's just I just hated the idea of like the cars are on display at this party, and one guy gets mad because his girlfriend's with someone else, so he jumps in a car and steals it because you can just start that up, you know, on a display stand, assuming it even has an engine in it to begin with.
Where does Senna fit into this?
Oh, as a documentary?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I guess I wasn't including it because it's a documentary, but it's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, it's I made my wife watch that.
Yeah.
She is not into auto racing, and she loves it. She loves Senna now. She loves everything about him. That's an amazing film, too. So I would recommend those. Yeah.
It's a surprising lack of
good racing movies.
Good racing movies. I feel like there was kind of a run of them in probably the 60s or whatever.
The other one that's always in discussion, and it's I hope I'm saying this right. I've been saying it wrong my entire life, but it's Le Mans. It's the Steve McQueen sort of passion project. I think most people's take on it is that the movie's not that great, but the racing footage is amazing.
Yeah. No dialogue for the first 20 minutes or 40 minutes or something in that?
There are big chunks where it's just you're just racing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a great opening scene where McQueen's character is basically driving his 911S. It's like an early, a long hood, you know, probably early 70s 911, just around the track, but before it's been turned into the track, while it's still open country roads at points. And he's driving in. He's trying to get a feel for it. He comes to the corner where he had his big crash the year before, and has a moment, an existential crisis.
Yeah.
But the footage is amazing. The cars are real. It was a real at the time. It was a big Steve McQueen had a lot of weight at that time, and he was throwing it around making that movie.
Yeah.
So, but the movie isn't quite as good.
Okay.
Rush and Ford v Ferrari are much better standalone movies that anybody can enjoy, I think.
Well, I've got some movies to catch up on, but I should definitely start with this. So maybe we'll go see it together.
Yeah, I think.
You said this theater has a bar, so that...
Absolutely. You yeah. know,
why say
yeah.
no?
I'm never going to a theater without a bar.
Right?
Yeah. Why should I have
years
to do that?
Years went to
years. I've been putting up with sobriety as I'm watching these movies, and I need some of these movies. I need
easier. Some of these movies.
It would be so much better.
Right.
I think the people that make these movies should put the bars in. They should buy me a beer or two before I go in. I'll be much nicer when
you on the critics' line. $14.
It was. It was a big 22-ounce IPA. So yeah, it kind of helped me get me about halfway through the movie.
Okay.
So that might say more about me than about the bar, but you know,
yeah. we'll have to go.
I'll go check it out. We'll go check it out together,
we'll do that,
and I will show you. I own Rush, and I will have screened that for you here at the Casa de la Fogler at some point. So
let's do it.
Yeah.
Well, should we take a break here?
Yeah, let's take a pause, and we'll come back, and we'll finish up.
We'll be back.
Yeah. All right, we're back. I want to use this last segment to kind of talk about something that kind of came and went a little while back. I always meant to talk about it, and we never got a chance to. And I'd also heard that one of our fans would be really interested in hearing about this subject. So, Colson, Janko, this is for you. we're going to talk a little bit about World...
We should say Colson is 7.
He is, but you know, aren't all of us like still like a 7-year-old boy still on the inside a little bit?
I wanted to sort of frame this for what it is.
I wasn't going to throw him under the bus, but since we have, Colson is 7, and he told us that he would be interested in hearing a discussion about the fastest cars in the world, and I thought I was going to segue it by kind of talking a little bit about. I feel like that Bugatti Chiron Supersport or will be Supersport, you know, model kind of came and went. Like it kind of came, set a record, and then kind of just sort of faded out of the discussion. And you and I never had a chance to talk about it. And I guess here's what I'll start it off with: is like, I don't know, do we care about this anymore? Is this something that we're interested in?
That's kind of you know, at what point are these numbers just sort of irrelevant, right?
Yeah.
If you need 5 miles to achieve the top speed.
Yeah, although
where do you do it?
The Bugatti. Well, yeah. There's the one problem is that it's fast become. This is one of the problems I've learned in researching this subject a little bit is that the Volkswagen test track is about the only place where you can do this anymore.
Right.
And Volkswagen Auto Group won't let anyone else come in and try their stuff there. So it gets a little tough. Yeah. Well, so
McLaren has been using northbound I-25
here. Yeah, apparently. the on ramp at Hamden, right, is the launching ramp. I mean, I guess I kind of thought that I didn't care about this anymore.
Yeah.
But then I found myself strangely intrigued when that Bugatti kind of came out of nowhere and just sort of set the record again.
Well, and the whole electric car thing sort of puts us in a new light too, right? Like you always hear about how quick to accelerate some of these electric cars are, but you never hear about top speed being an attribute. Right?
Yeah, no, it's really not.
Yeah. Yeah, like I couldn't tell you what the top speed of a dual motor P100 or whatever Tesla is. I know that it can scoot to 60 and
ludicrous speed,
or whatever,
basically.
But I have no idea, and I know those are single speed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's the Regera, the Koenigsegg that's a single gear tune that obviously has some wildly high top speeds. Lots of questions, but
lots of questions, not many answers. I guess, you're
thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, that's what you get when you tune into us. So, I mean, what I had heard, and I'm going to butcher these numbers a little bit, but what I had heard is that, you know, when it comes to top speed of some of these cars, like getting the car up to 100 miles an hour, you know, takes, you know, somewhere, and even like 120, 130, only takes about 250 horsepower of a car.
Okay.
It's, you know, these cars with this insane horsepower, that's you know, of the rest of that horsepower is what usually requires to getting them up to that, you know, into that next threshold. So the over 200 miles an hour. So you're using like a tremendous amount of horsepower to get those last like two to 3 miles per hour, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, electric engines, as we know, they deliver all their torque immediately off the line, but not, you know,
before someone calls us on this, they're electric. We should establish, right? They're electric motors. Engines are an internal combustion.
Okay.
Motors are electric, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I feel like we're having a fire truck moment again. So
what? Well, you know, someone's going to say something.
You're absolutely right. No. So
and this has always bothered me because.
So I'm supposed to say motor, right? I'm not supposed to say. Not engine.
I know I'm being pedantic.
No, it's okay. But that's I want to get the terminology right. So I'm supposed to say electric motor.
Electric motor.
Yeah.
But we use that. We use motor for engines too, and we don't really think.
Well, so is that the umbrella term though, right? Like motor is An engine is a kind of motor.
A motive device or whatever. Okay, all right. This is it's not worth it.
Yeah, we've gotten off the reservation here. But what I, as a sort of a brief history of sort of the top speed records from my recollection is, one of my earliest impressions of, or memories of cars in general was getting the Road and Track, fastest car edition in 1987. And that's the one where the roof Yellowbird just came out of nowhere. 211. It was it was this turbocharged, 911. It was just a 3.2, base motor that day, stuff like that. It beat the 959. It beat
the F40, right?
That car was available at the time. It wasn't at that test. Oh. I don't know. But I think it did beat it. I think their top speed was only 200 with that, or 199 or something.
And, yeah.
I mean, it'd be, everything else, and by a healthy margin,
So are a Road and Track guy.
I grew up as a Road and Track guy.
I was a car and driver guy.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I always get Road and Track as well.
And somehow we make this work. I don't know. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad was a staunch, loyal, dedicated to this day still Road and Track subscriber. Yeah. So,
well, Peter Egan really made that.
He was a big part of that. He was great. But I mean, it had like great photography. It always had like exciting stories. I don't know. It had a focus on motorsports.
Like the experiential stuff, the stories, the road trips, and all that. Car and driver was really like the road tests. Right?
Yeah, no, they were really they were really nuts and bolts, like getting down to those numbers.
You talked about your dad. Grew up with the Ferrari versus Ford V Ford.
Right. Learning
Ford
that
V Ferrari or Ferrari V Ford?
Ford V Ferrari.
Ford V Ferrari. That does have a better cadence. But yeah, I was the same way. I wasn't into sports, and like you said, some people with baseball. But for me, it was I would memorize as car and driver, road test digests, I think they were called, like they were baseball stats.
Yeah, pour over those numbers.
Like there was that era, like mid to late 90s where I can tell you what a Pontiac Firehawk SLP, do in the cars. I don't really care about
the quarter mile time.
You've forgotten about, right? Yeah. And I think that's why I appreciate Car and Driver. But then as I got older, Road and Track in the stories was, because they were different. And I feel like now all the magazines are kind of interchangeable.
Yeah.
Motor Trend is garbage back then, honestly. Now they've actually gotten better.
They're owned by the same people as Road and Track now. But it's hard to be in publishing. But yeah, I mean, and I'll say that, at my house it was Road and Track. But then once I started going to school and I went to the library, and then I would read all of them. Like I would read the Motor Trend, the Car and Driver, whatever, I would read whatever I could get my hands on. But yeah, but I still, to this day, I still, I have my own subscription to Road and Track. I always read it, and I always look forward to the magazine. And their website has actually come along really well. I like looking at their website now as much as anything else.
Really?
So yeah, I'm enjoying it. Yeah. No, not for you.
I've just never
checked it out.
RoadandTrack.com. I would pick up the magazine before I go to the website.
I do when I'm at if I'm at work and I can't get my hands on the magazine, I'll flip open the webpage. So
so you've got a bookmark other than for Bring a Trailer.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's most of my web browsing history is primarily Bring a Trailer, and then about 20%.
Can I sidebar here for a second?
Sure, go for
counsel.
It. Yeah, you have the floor.
Yeah, so we've talked about Bring a Trailer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, right?
I don't think I have, actually.
Oh, you've never seen it's Thanksgiving time.
Is that the one with John Candy
John
and Steve
Candy
Martin?
John Candy and Steve Martin, and it is one of my favorite movies of all time. All right,
I will put that on my list then, Sorry.
Yeah, no, but there's a scene where they're on a bus, right? They're like in this trailways bus at the back by the toilet, and they're trying to get everyone, they're trying to have a moment with people on the bus and trying to connect, and there's a suggestion, I guess, to sing a song, or people are singing songs, and Steve Martin starts singing, and I didn't know this song until I saw the movie, but Three Coins in a Fountain, so he starts doing this Three Coins in a Fountain, and expects the rest of the bus to, and much like the look you're giving me now, people have no,
no
idea what
you're
talking about, and so John Candy then dives into Flintstones, Meet the Flintstones, and everyone on the bus
So he was able to find the pop culture common ground.
He was able to that's what it took, right? And I always sort of, we've talked about Bring a Trailer, and Bring a Trailer is sort of, especially now that it's been live for a while, has always sort of been this, it's sort of turned into this, a little bit of a clicky thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a registered user commenter for a while now,
mm-hmm.
and I've made what I thought were sort of several educated, insightful comments, and I'd get maybe a like or not a like at all, and it kind of given up on commenting. And then there was a BMW. What is it? The E9. What's the V8 M3? It's the E90. The E90 is the Forder.
Yeah.
And
the first V8 M3.
Yeah, and I made the only V8 M3, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and I made the comment that was on the 18-inch wheels. There was an 18-inch wheel option, a 19-inch wheel option, a 20-inch wheel option, and I made the comment, and it was, you know, so from the heart, I guess I said, it's the 18-inch wheels. I always thought those were the best looking wheels. It's very simple. Comment. I like the 18-inch wheels on that car. 9 likes.
Anyway, yeah, you were excited about that.
You're excited when you first yellowed comment.
You said that, and I said, "What does that mean?" He goes, "I got 5 likes."
But I immediately thought of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It's just like, oh,
you had your Flintstones moment.
Yes, there we go. Anyway, so
well,
back to Road and Track,
fastest cars is. Well, you know, so I said, I kind of checked, I didn't really like follow this thing like super closely, but I kept checking in as like, you know, the record got broken and, you know, that roof had it for a long time, but it was when the McLaren F1 came along and it smashed the record and went to 231 or something.
Yeah, that sounds right. I think 230 is a number I remember.
Yeah.
But maybe car driver didn't quite get it up.
They may have had it. I mean, it was, you know, and it was a car they didn't necessarily design to break this, you know, fastest record. They figured out that they, you know, based on the gearing and the engine that they could get it, and they did. And then the McLaren held that from a long time, from 93 to 05. A
shockingly long.
A long time. It was, I mean, it was a fast, actually, you know what? I think we're selling it short. I think. The McLaren F1 hit 240, over 240.
Maybe that's the number I remember.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we don't know what remember
so
means.
So high.
Yeah. But yeah, it hit 240.
Was I just bragging about how I remembered every fact and figure?
Yeah. I wasn't going to call you out and actually like start, you know, listing random cars from the 80s, 90s.
I was hoping you were going to ask about that Firehawk SLP.
So what was that SLP quarter mile
time? I think it was 0 to 60 in 5.2 seconds, or between 4.9 and 5.2, which is shockingly fast. Yeah. I mean, my base Cayman's faster than that now.
Yeah.
And I want to say the quarter mile.
But at the time,
like 13.9 or 14.1 or something. Yeah. I'm going to check this and we'll.
I do remember that kind of came at a time, obviously, coming out of the malaise era of GM, and that was like a legitimate 305 horsepower rear wheel drive sports car that was like quasi affordable.
No, it actually looked pretty decent.
Yeah, it was one of the better looking Firebirds.
To a young man growing up in central Indiana.
That might as well have been a Ferrari. But then, as we know, I mean, the Bugatti Veyron came along in the mid 2000s, and that held the record for a while. There, it seems like there were a couple. I mean, the SCC Ultimate Aero TT. This is the next thing on the list here. I don't really know what you call like a real production car but I don't know. I thought it was. You know, I thought it was kind of interesting when the Chiron, you know, they did a modified version, which in some people's, you know, books, you know, shouldn't count because it's not based on a production car. But I think if they take those, you know, changes and introduce it as the Super Sport, I think you got the record again.
Yeah.
I was a little surprised. I was kind of happy about it. So it hit over 250.
That's amazing. Amazing thing about that was that it was a GT car.
The Bugatti in general,
it was a luxury car. It was heavy. It had leather. I mean, this was not a car that was stripped out with carbon fiber and, you know.
It is a very comfortable way to go extremely fast. I mean, I think that's kind of like the ultimate sort of, that's the ultimate luxury, right? Is to be able to travel continents at high speed and exceptional comfort. So, I mean, I guess I was even surprised that I was interested in it because I've kind of yawned about this show.
Oh, shockingly small in person.
Is it? Oh, have you seen one?
It's one of those. I've not seen the new one, but the Veyron.
Oh, the Veyron, yeah.
And I think they're about the same size. I don't know why, you know, you'd see them, these splashed on the front of the covers of magazines or just the numbers were so big. I thought that about, it's funny, I thought that about a lot of exotic cars, you know, they're so larger than life, right? And you see one and they're tiny. Not always. There's some cars that have surprised me at how big they are.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that McLaren, what was that first McLaren-Mercedes combo car that they did that was like, it was all hood.
Long hood, yeah.
That one looked pretty good. That one was
one way or the other.
I saw one of those in real life, and it was huge. So.
But anyway, back to the Bugatti. And so the Chiron now holds the...
It's considered an unofficial record.
That's right. Because they didn't do it in two directions or something.
No, they did do it in two directions, but it doesn't hold the production car record because it was modified, and I think there might have been another thing that kept it from it. But it did. I was underselling it again. This is saying 304. That's what it was. It cracked 300 miles an hour.
That's insane. Like we jumped from 240 to 300 and.
Yeah, and in a relatively about 15 years time, basically. I mean, that's just a big number.
They still do like the different keys.
I don't know. I think so.
They still do the special Michelin.
It was one key. It was one key for regular speeds, and then to unlock the rest of the achievements.
Right.
Yeah, the tires are something insane. The tires
have to be shipped to France or whatever.
Everything. Right. The maintenance on the Veyron and I assume on the Chiron are like it's just insane.
It just seems like
$20,000 for a tire. Yeah. You know, like it has 17 radiators. If you run the car, if you run the car at full speed, it'll run out of gas in, you know, like 2 minutes or something. It's okay because at 4 minutes the tires will burst anyways. So you know.
So are we saying to our young listener that this is the?
I think it's
widely accepted.
I guess I'm meandering on this. The lesson I want to impart is that I thought I didn't care about it anymore, but I think when that Bugatti hit over 300, it caught my attention again. I think this is something I care about.
Yeah.
Especially as the future goes to electric, and I wonder if these things will be getting these kind of gains anymore. I feel like there'll be a regression for a while. I think the Chiron will hold it for a long time, and then at some point, some sort of car that we barely even recognize as an automobile will that's almost like a plane will basically beat this thing. But I think there is something to be said for it. I think it is kind of a lost art of sort of like manufacturers going out there and trying to up themselves. I would hope that Volkswagen would allow other manufacturers to come to their track and try and get this record.
So, I would argue that this is going to evolve into something more like top speed in a mile or something. There's going to be some sort of like distance.
Yeah, it may be
put on it. Maybe
we're reaching numbers and performances on cars right now. That's getting a little start. I mean, the 0 to 60 time. There's not much left for cars to accelerate faster. I'd read somewhere about how like the top fuel dragsters and the National Hot Rod Association in general, they had to change. They had to change the distances because they were basically like, we're getting too quick and we're going to start turning people's guts inside out if we don't do something. So like they had to like, so they do a different, they do shorter or longer or something.
I hear that argument and I think there's probably something to it. But if you go back to the 20s and the 30s, you know, some of these first fast cars, people had the same issue. Oh, we can't get any faster than this.
Yeah, well, yeah. But there's not much time left between 0 and 60. Like, we can
always split a hair.
What's the 911 Turbo S at?
The 911 Turbo.
The current one, the 991.
It's like 2.1 or 2.5 or something, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's about as fast as any electric car could go too, right? I mean, that's, you know, has anything broken the 2 second mark? I don't know.
It's like
I never know who to believe. I never know what you know.
And so, for example, we're going to have to stop, we're going to have to basically drop the 0 to 60, which is like a currency that we understand, and they're going to have to start doing, like, what's the 0 to 100 time? What's the 0 to 120?
Well, the 0 to 60 time never really was a great sort of indicator of a car's performance anyway, right? Because, you know, one shift, one more or less shift, right?
Yeah, it seemed to be very geared.
The quarter mile dependent. For me was the better sort of performance indicator. But remember, I think this Car and Driver did this, or maybe still doing this, right? The 0 to 150 back to 0.
Yeah, Road and Track did that for a while. It was interesting.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, obviously, there are plenty of cars now that, I mean, I would say the majority of cars being sold out can't hit 150. So, you know, maybe we drop that to 100 or 120 or something. But as far as sports cars, I would say most sports cars sold now probably hit 150. I mean, does the 86 hit 150 eventually?
Well, I know
Mace Cayman can do, I think, 168, so...
I don't know. My 2014 WRX was limited to, like, 140.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, and it may not have been actually electronically limited, but that was the car's top speed was 140, so...
Well, and I wouldn't want to drive 168 in my Cayman either, but...
I don't want to drive 155
But I do, I like WRX, the idea of that, though, of the, you know, the... But then you get into some car, okay, but then if you're starting at zero... Mm-hmm. You know, you're giving an all-wheel drive car or an automatic car an advantage, right?
Yeah.
You know, so something to be said for a rolling start, right? I mean, I guess where do you...
Well, I'd also heard that, you know, I never thought of it this way, but hill climbs, which are something that have sort of fallen out of favor in general... Yeah. Is actually like a great performance test for cars because it's testing the engine, transmission, suspension, and brakes.
Yeah.
You know,
because
you're going uphill, you're basically always on the engine.
And
basically,
here we are,
so,
in Colorado, too far from the Pikes Peak, which is a mecca, hill climb.
Yeah, the mecca of hill climb events. Yeah. Not to mention, I always thought Colorado should have more local, more hill climb events going on throughout
we
the year.
We used
year,
to go,
so,
and they still do this. I want to say it's like the Alfa Romeo Club or something actually runs it, but in New Glarus, Wisconsin, which is kind of a neat town. Swiss established town and still has a Swiss vibe to it, and it's also sort of the door to a lot of what they call the driftless region of southwestern Wisconsin, where it's the glaciers didn't scrape the landscape flat, and so a lot of great driving roads. Also near Spring Green, Frank Lloyd Wright, all that area. But New Glarus does this hill climb every year, and it's pretty cool. And we would go, and we, you know, there would be a range of stuff. The only time I've ever seen a Lotus Europa actually functioning and driving, I saw on this hill climb. Old Rolls Royce,
lumbering up the hill,
and everything in between. And it was really, you know, and of course we made sure to sit on the most dangerous corner, you know, because when you have amateurs flying by in cars, you know, that were
that's where you want to be,
right? That's
right, the outside of our apex,
photos, right? But it was always really, really cool. And to your point, it really sort of showcased everything, you know, and you know, I mean, you know, Matt Farah always talks to you about how, you know, different a car is going uphill versus downhill, right? And, and so it really is, it really does give you a good sense, I think, of how
overall performance.
Yeah. You know? So this is not the fastest car in the world, but Bugatti it is, you think?
So that's, you know, that's my kind of my brief history, and I'm sorry this isn't as in depth as some of my lectures are, but so currently a modified version of the Chiron, the Bugatti Chiron, is the current holder.
Okay.
And it cracked 300, which is it was a number that made me stand up and notice.
A car like the Koenigsegg 111 or 1-to-1 or whatever they're calling it is probably faster to 150 or something, but it can't reach that.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about top speed, you're getting into, like, you know, the aerodynamics and things like that. Yeah. So what makes a GT3 fast is what's going to hold it back from, like, you know, holding the top speed record because of all the downforce. I have a feeling that's what some of these cars, you want to strip them all down, take all the wings off and stuff. So, but, you know,
interesting conversation. We'll do some more research.
Colson will follow up with this. We'll give you a.
That's our first reader question.
It is, yeah. We're going to call that our first reader question. Yeah. So,
thank you, Colson.
Colson, I hope you enjoy that. If you have any questions, go ahead and ask us. You can email us at the steering committee at gmail.com, or you can just talk to us in person since you know us. So,
if you live down the street,
don't be afraid. Just come over and ask us.
That's right. We'll take all comers. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, we're gonna wrap that wrap this up for tonight. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for coming over and doing this with me tonight.
Pleasure. So, we'll talk again in a week.
Yeah, sounds good.